So when my dad was secular growing up, and when my dad started to consider God, what God was like, if he was real and what he would look like and what he'd be like, a number of Christians came along, a concerted amount of Christians came along and interacted with my father on this and introduced the idea of the Christian God to him. And that's kind of an important thing, that it was not just one person. It was many people would just kind of bounce into his life and tell him, in some sense, about Jesus, so that he was able to put the pieces together at the appropriate time. And that speaks to the need we all have to be in consistent fellowship with unbelievers and to be telling them the frank things about what we believe if they're willing to listen to it. And one particular person would just sit there and say, "Well, do you have any questions for me about this?" And so my father asked this question at some point. He said, "What will following Jesus cost? What's the cost here?" And this person looked over at him and he said, "Listen, there's no cost at all." That's what he said. "Listen, there's no, it will cost you nothing." Now, as my father suspected at the time and learned later, this was a massive lie. It was a massive lie. It's not that it was no cost. Well, what do I mean by that? You know what? Let's get some ideas straight. You are not going to earn your way to heaven. You're not going to do anything that is a good work that God is going to say, "Now I will receive you into heaven." It's a free gift that God offers. He has laid down his life in Christ for you. He's died the death that you deserve. We'll get into that a bit more, but you just receive that. But that being said, following Jesus costs everything. Following Jesus costs everything. There's always a cost. And for my father, the immediate cost was that he lost relationships. Instantly, all the drug addict friends that he had, they wanted nothing to do with him. There's always a cost. And what does the Bible say? Well, as we look at Jesus's life and we've seen who Jesus is, we've heard him say things like, "Whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for the kingdom will find it. I've come not to serve, but to be served, but to serve and to give my life as a ransom." He's saying these sorts of things. And now he's going to live that out. He's going to go and purposely give up his life for the kingdom. That's the plan. And all the fanboys that have been sitting there enjoying the miracle worker and the happy guy who just loves people and just does these amazing, fantastic things, they start to see that he's headed towards death and they say, "You know, this isn't my scene. I got to bail. I better offload now, or I'm going to die with this guy too." And the question that is posed to us in these next few chapters is, will anyone go with Jesus to lose his life, to lose their life? Will anyone follow Jesus all the way up the hill to die to self? Now, Jesus chose to lose his life for you. Will you follow in his footsteps? Jesus chose to lose his life for you. Will you follow in his footsteps? I want to start with this idea that every pretender is going to be unmasked. Every pretender is going to be unmasked. And what that means is that those who really don't want to lose their life, eventually that's going to become clear. And eventually they're going to find themselves making their way towards the door. So look with me at verse 1 here of chapter 14 of Mark. Chapter 14, it's in page 1019 of the Blue Bibles, which I think some of you actually do have with you. Page 1019, 14, verse 1 says this: Now the Passover and the festival of the unleavened bread were only 2 days away. The chief priests and the teachers of the laws were scheming to arrest Jesus secretly and kill him. "But not during the festival," they said, "or the people may riot." Okay, now jump down with me to verse 10. It says this: Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. They were delighted to hear this and promised to give him money. So he watched for an opportunity to hand him over. So here we have the scribes and the Pharisees and the leaders. And the thing that has been shown is that they are pretenders. They are pretenders. They pretend to be religious and they pretend to love God. But all of that is just a veneer to seek money and fame and prestige and glory. And the reality is they're in Rome's pocket. Okay, they've been bought by Rome. They have a job to do. And if they do that job, they can keep their position as high priest. They can keep their position and they can keep their glory in front of the people. And so actually, what are they? They're mafia members. They're mafia members. They're collecting money from the people and they're giving it to Rome. That's what a mafia does, okay? It even does give money to Rome, okay? Anyway, and what has happened is Jesus has come along and he's exposed the hypocrisy of their religion. And it is humiliating. And so they must get rid of this man. Now, Jesus is in town for Passover, and that's prime time to nab him. He's close. But they think we can't do it in public because these people believe in this man. And they'll start a riot. And then we'll look bad to our employers, and they may take our job away. They may sack us. So they need an inside man. And the inside man is Judas Iscariot. Just to start with, the man's name means Israel always breaks the covenant. That's what the man's name means. Judah ben Kariot. Okay, it sounds like it's a double entendre. Okay, Kariot could mean something else, but it sounds like Judah or Israel as a whole, the one who breaks the covenant, the one who has cut the covenant, ruined the covenant. Well, who is this man? There's a lot of speculation about who he is, why he did what he did, but I want to show you that everything you need to know about Judas, we can get from this story right in front of us. Everything you need to know, you can get from the story of the woman who breaks the alabaster and pours it on Jesus, and then Judas goes out straight away and says, I want money for Jesus, and I'll betray him. So look at verse 3 here. While he was in Bethany, reclining at the table in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on his head. Some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, "Why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor." And they rebuked her. "Leave her alone," said Jesus. "Why are you bothering her? She's done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you. You can help them anytime you like, but you will not always have me." She did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. Truly, I tell you, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the whole world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. So there is a feast going on here. This is a thank you meal that is taking place. We know from other gospels all the details of this meal. So the details are is that Lazarus has been raised from the dead. Lazarus has been raised from the dead. And they put on this meal to kind of celebrate with Jesus this raising from the dead. It says it's at Simon the leper's house. And Simon the leper is likely Lazarus's dad. Okay, and so he's having this meal, and there is a woman, she's unnamed, but actually we find out her name is Miriam, and she is Lazarus's brother or sister, okay? And she, in thankfulness, she goes and she pours a lifetime of perfume on Jesus's head in one go. And for you who have bought an expensive perfume, you know what you do with it. After you buy it, you don't pour it all out. You take the smallest drop of it. And if you take more than the smallest drop of it, your friends start to be like, "Why did you do that? You were kind of smelly." She takes the whole thing, a lifetime of perfume, just pours it out on Jesus. And this is way more expensive than anything you get from Chanel, okay? Right? This is a spikenard. It comes from India. Did you guys know that they talked with each other, you know, the Middle East with India and actually with China, that they had some connection with each other? Anyway, this has been procured from very far away. And undoubtedly, this is this woman's life savings. And then look at this. Judas gets the disciples to fall out with her. Okay, we know that Judas instigates this, to fall out with her and get her in trouble for this. And so Jesus rebukes Judas and the disciples who are partaking of this idea. And then straight away, Judas goes out and sells him out. Straight away. So what's Judas's problem? Well, in part, it must be money, mustn't it? Money, 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 right? Because John tells us as well that he's a thief and he steals from the box that this money would go into. And so he's upset about that. And of course, he's going to go now and he's going to sell Jesus for cash to the Pharisees and to the leaders. Obviously, part of the problem here is money. But there's more. There's more. Look at the gripe here in verse 5, what they say. They say, why was this not given to the poor? Why was this not given to the poor? Well, what's wrong with giving nice things to the poor? Jesus is all about the poor. This is, they've got a good point, do they? Well, this might look altruistic, but it's not at all thus. And so turn back with me just to chapter 12. We're going to read verse 41. And this is what it says. Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put and watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Many rich people threw in large amounts, but a poor widow came and put in two very small copper coins worth only a few pence. Calling his disciples, Jesus said, truly I tell you, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They gave out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put everything that she had to live on. Now, this incident that I've just read is time-wise a day or two ago. So because we have this close-up view of the things leading to Jesus' death, this is not in the distant past at all. This is just a few days prior. And what happened is every Passover, they would say, it's important that you give to the poor. And so they would set these giant jars out, these giant jars with material that made jangly sounds. And so people would put in their alms. It was a mitzvah, okay? Give to the poor. It's a mitzvah. It's a command. You need to do this. And so they would come and they would go and they would do the Passover. Before they did that, they would go and they would give to the poor in front of everyone. And they would make lines and you would go to the jar and you would toss in your money. And of course, if you had a year's wage worth of money, man, you have an orchestra of sound. Ding, 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 ding. Look at me. I'm making it rain. And the glory would be yours. And the prestige and the honor. You are somebody notable. Look what you just did. And this is what the disciples are imagining. We could have had the fame. Even though Jesus says, don't do your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you'll have no reward from your Father in heaven. So when you give, Jesus says, don't let your left hand know what your right is doing. Well, obviously, if you have that amount of money, you're dumping it all in front of everybody. It's all falling flat. It's not altruistic. It's still living for self. And so Judas and the disciples, they're still in it for the glory. They're still in it for the glory. Now, the disciples are kind of learning to turn away from that. But Judas, he's incensed by this, and so he goes. Now, look, this woman is just like the woman who threw in all that she had, Miriam. Mary is just like the woman who threw in those two copper coins, which was all she had. Look at verse 8 there. Verse 8 says, she did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. Those words, she did what she could, literally What she had, she gave. All that she found in her hands, she gave it. And so she's just like this other woman who is giving all of herself over to the kingdom. She's given all that she had in her hands. You know, God doesn't ask you to give more than what you have, but he asks you to give what you have. And that's what he wants from his followers. And so she's losing her life for the kingdom. And that means she's a real follower. Meanwhile, the disciples are totally capricious here. You know, this woman does not know that Jesus is about to die. But the disciples surely do know this. Well, they know that Jesus said this is going to happen. But they're ignoring that. And they're saying, no, that's not going to happen. And it's likely at this point that Jesus has told them, listen, we got about a day left, guys. And they're doing nothing to honor Jesus, to say, you are so wonderful. Thank you, Jesus, for loving us. And you're getting ready towards your death. We don't understand, but we love you. And we brought some perfume for you. And we're going to anoint your body. No, they don't do any of that because they don't even believe that's going to happen because it's all about them and their glory. And so this woman, God puts it on her heart to do this thing. And she is the one to show Jesus compassion before he goes to the cross. But the disciples are not about to lay down their life. And Judas is incensed. And so he says, I'm going to continue to live for myself. And Judas's thinking here is, Jesus says that he's going to die. You know what? I might as well make some money off of this. If Jesus is going to die and I'm not going to do that, I'm not going that direction. What am I going to do? I'm going to make some cash. And so Judas goes and he sells out Jesus. And in doing so, he ends up looking just like the leaders and the Pharisees. That's what they're living for, the glory and the fame and the prestige. And now it turns out that there's somebody in Jesus' ranks who is just like them. He's a wolf in sheep's clothing. And so he's outed as a pretender. And he has a religious veneer, but he has a different heart on the inside. And look at this. When he goes to the Pharisees and the leaders, they're overjoyed. I mean, what brings them joy is possibly putting to death an innocent man. And that shows you about what their heart is like in the end, doesn't it? We would rather have our things than God's things. We would rather have the things that we selfishly hold on to than that Jesus would reign in us. It's for their continued delusion that they're going to put Jesus to death. Now, there are pretenders in our midst. One such pretender is named Rabbi Zacharias. Oh, he was so great. People were moved to tears listening to his eloquence. And yet, he had another God, didn't he? And God reveals Judas. And God revealed Rabbi. That's how it works. God will not let us worship two gods. If we want to worship two gods, he's going to show us the door. He says, you choose one or the other. You choose, you sacrifice, and you lose your life with me, or you don't. Because see, Judas isn't the most evil man. He's just a normal bloke. He's a normal bloke who wouldn't lay down his life to Christ. And see, those who won't surrender to the Lord, those who won't lay down their lives, eventually they end up parting ways with Jesus. And so Jesus has warned all along that this would be the case. If anyone wants to come after me, he says, you must deny yourself, take up your Christ. He's warned all along that we need to sit down and consider whether we're willing to give our whole selves. Otherwise, don't build this building because you won't finish it, Jesus says. And so we need to take that to heart today. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to be people who go out and do a bunch of good works and see now we've discovered that we are good enough. It means that we're going to surrender to Jesus. We're just going to, in our hearts, say, no, I really do want you and I want to love you and I need your help. So that's the first point. The pretenders are unmasked. Second point is that Jesus will truly surrender his life. He is going to lose his life for us. He's determined to do it and he has to go to a great extent to make it happen. And we see this in verse 12. On the first day of the festival of unleavened bread, when it was customary to sacrifice the Passover lamb, Jesus' disciples asked him, "Where do you want us to go and make preparations for you to eat Passover?" So he sent two of his disciples, telling them, "Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him. Say to the owner of the house, he enters, 'The teacher asks, where's my guest room, where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large room upstairs, furnished and ready. Make preparations for us there.' Then the disciples left, went into the city, and found things just as Jesus had told them. So they prepared the Passover. When evening came, Jesus arrived with the 12. While they were reclining at the table, eating, he said, 'Truly, I will tell you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me.' They were grieved. And one by one, they said to him, 'Surely you don't mean me.' 'It's one of the 12, he replied, 'one who is dipping the bread in the bowl with me. The Son of Man will go, just as it is written about him. But woe to that man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born.' While they were eating, Jesus took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to the disciples, saying, 'Take it, this is my body.' Then he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them. They all drank from it. 'This is the blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many.' He said to them, 'Truly, I tell you, I'll not drink again from the fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God.'" The kingdom of God. So there is a lot of debate in scholarly circles about when precisely Jesus has his Passover and when precisely Jesus dies on the cross. And we simply do not have enough time to go through all the possibilities, but I'm pretty sure I know what is taking place here. And a careful reading of everything indicates that Jesus is purposely going to have his Passover meal the day before Passover starts. Okay, you have Passover on the first day of Passover. So that the day before everything begins, that's when Jesus has his Passover meal. And the reason is because he knows before Passover really begins, I'm going to be judged and convicted and crucified. And so Jesus wants to eat the Passover and to be the Passover lamb. Well, we're going to get into that a little bit more. But the disciples are saying, listen, where do you want us to celebrate your Passover? And that word "your" means this is your idea. We're going a bit early here, Jesus, and this seems to be something that you're interested in. And so we can catch that ring of denial inside of the disciples. So they don't think Jesus is going to die. And we're going early? This is a bit weird. Where do you want us to eat your Passover? And so Jesus kind of has like this James Bond moment. I love it. He says, here's what you do. You're going to go down this road to this place, and you'll see a guy with a jar on his head. Follow that guy. And then when you follow him, he'll go to a room. Then you got to say the password. Okay, the password is, where is the room so that the master can eat with his disciples? And he'll have a room for you, so go do this. And then you can just see the dun, 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 dun. This is all on the sly, okay? Jesus is not normally going to be able to have a Passover because they're looking to arrest him and throw him in prison and execute him. And so he's just going to sneak into Jerusalem, and he's going to go a day early. And he's obviously planned this for a while. And so why is he doing all this? So that he can make sure that he's actually going to die when he's supposed to die. And that's what Jesus is doing here. I want to die when I'm supposed to die. I'm going to lose my life. And I want to make sure it's exactly the way that it should be. And I want to eat the Passover because it turns out I am the Passover. Now, look, they're sitting around during the Passover. They're eating. And he says, well, actually, one of you guys is going to betray me. And I love what the disciples say here. One by one, they say, it isn't me, is it? And you know, normally when someone says one of you is going to betray me, you don't say, it isn't me, is it? You say, it's not me. Let's find the guy and get rid of him, okay? But it's not me. And so the disciples here, they believe in Jesus's words so strongly that they're now questioning, maybe I'm the accidental murderer here. And they've wrapped their world around Jesus. Not nearly enough that they're willing to go all the way with Jesus to the crucifixion, but enough so that they're questioning and saying, I want to see things Jesus's way. But why does Jesus do this? He names that there is a betrayer because he wants everyone to know, listen, in a few days I'm going to die. This is not an accident, and I am laying down my life willingly. This person is not taking my life away. Whoever that person is, who is one of you 12 in this room that is just eating some food with me, whoever that is, I am not, he's not catching me by surprise. I'm laying down my life. I choose to do this for you. Does that move you? Does that move you? That Jesus is saying, I choose to go to the cross. I choose to go to the cross for you, Tim. I plan to go to the cross for you. It's for you that I do this. It's not just some man that 2,000 years ago died on a cross because he wanted to give us inspiration or something. And isn't that lovely? It's personal. I set this up for you. I'm choosing to lose my life. A second reason that Jesus did this is a warning to Judas. There's a warning here. We have to hear this warning. The Son of Man goes, but woe to the man through whom the Son of Man is going to go. It'd be better for him if he were not born. Let me tell you, there's a lot of people, and it's just going to be better for them if they were not born. And that should be something that makes us cry. That they're going to say, I don't want to live for Jesus. I don't want to live for the kingdom. In fact, I don't even think God exists. I'm just going to do what I want. And then they need to be told that that's not just going to end happy. That's not just a decision they can make and just kind of move on with their life. But they're going to wish they'd never existed than to have done what they did. And we have to help them out before they suffer eternal regret. And Jesus is saying, he makes it nice and neutral. That man, whoever it is who does this, it would be better if they wouldn't do that because they would, you know, he's offering the idea to Judas, listen, you could do something else. You don't want to do that. But it doesn't work. Now let's talk about the symbolism of the Passover. What does this mean? Jesus takes some bread. He says, this is my body. He takes the cup. He says, this is my blood. What in the world is he talking about? Well, something interesting is going on here. Since Jesus is not celebrating Passover during Passover, but the day before, that means that he cannot have a lamb because you get the lamb on the day of preparation. Okay, you get the lamb midway through on the day, actually towards the afternoon, in the day of preparation. You take that lamb and you go and celebrate the Passover that evening. You get it from the temple. But if it's not there yet, what are you going to do? Well, it turns out that diaspora Jewish people, that means Jewish people who lived outside of Israel, the central government in Israel said, don't celebrate Passover with the lamb because you're not near the temple. And so they said, here's what you do. Have it without the lamb, but the bread that you eat, specifically the bread that you break, and the third cup of wine, that is going to be representative of the Passover lamb for you. Ah, and now we see, what does Jesus do? He takes the bread and he says, this is my body. He takes the cup. He says, this is my blood. He's saying, I'm the new Passover lamb. That's what he's saying. I'm the new Passover lamb. Well, that asks the question, what's the original Passover about? The original Passover about, we have to go back about 2,000 years from this point, well, actually 1,500 years. And the Jewish people are enslaved in Egypt, and God says, I'm going to rescue you, and there's miraculous signs. And then to cap it all off, the Egyptians, they cannot say no to God, and these signs come upon them. And then finally, he says, there's going to be one more horrifying miracle. And that's what it is. It's a horrifying miracle. And here's what it is. The angel of judgment is going to pass through Egypt, and all of the firstborns in Egypt are going to die. It's a terrible, terrible moment. And then he says, but those who will take a lamb and slaughter it and eat it and spread the blood of the lamb on the doorpost in a sign of faith, if they will do that, then the angel will pass over their house. And so Jesus is saying, I'm about to die, and I'm about to die so that judgment will pass over you. I'm about to die. And actually, so what we learn here is that the Passover, this strange set of events, is really all just leading towards Jesus. It doesn't make sense outside of that. Jesus wants to pass over us. Why? He's going to die for us. And he's going to die. And not only is he going to die, he's making a new covenant here with them. It's personal. Listen, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to die for you. You eat. You drink me in. And I'll save you. I'll sustain you. You'll live. I have chosen this. And so what Jesus is doing is he's saying, listen, in short hours, it's all going to go down and it's going to look like a freak accident. You know, you think about when John Lennon, for instance, was killed, right? He had no idea that somebody had been for 3 months planning his demise. Well, that's not what happens with Jesus. Jesus knows precisely what's going on and he runs to it. And he says, this isn't an accident. Look, here's some symbolism for you to understand. I'm giving you my body. I'm giving you my life. I will lose my life for the kingdom. I choose this. Jesus will lay down his life for you. Are you willing to come and follow him? Don't think that God is asking you for less. Don't think that God is asking you for less than surrender. So some reflections. Number one, do you realize that Jesus has done this for you? I hope you understand that Jesus's death is personal. It's about you. It's about you. Jesus saying, I don't want you to be judged. I want you to live. And so I'm going to be judged for you. And then the second, are you really losing your life? Are you following Jesus in that? I know that we think that life is about us. The very best thing that could happen to you is that you realize that life is not about you. It is about God. And that God has called you to come and join his thing, to trust in his son, to be delivered from your sins and become part of his kingdom. And that calls you to let go of the things of life, the things that you think you want. You may get some of those things, but you can't live for those things. You got to live for him. Well, I don't want to live for him, but I still kind of want to go to church every once in a while. Jesus says, go to the door. I don't want that. I want all of you. Now, here's what it's not saying. It's not saying go out and do a bunch of good works right now and earn your salvation. What it is saying is surrender to me. Trust me. Become mine. Eat my body. Drink my